and welcome to episode 7, from point A to point B and everywhere in between, of the Downtown Phoenix podcast. I am your host, Edward Jensen, and welcome back. This episode was recorded in the community studio of Downtown Phoenix, Inc. in Downtown Phoenix. We have three guests on this transportation-themed episode of the podcast, and I will introduce them presently. But first, as usual, there is a little bit of housekeeping that we need to do. As we announced at the beginning of this inaugural series of the podcast, our first series is going to be an 8-episode series that attempts to put context to our urban condition, as well as start a discussion about how to be better involved in improving our community. It is a task to which we remain fully committed, no matter what happens. But next week's episode marks the inaugural series finale. We will take some time off and regroup and assess what we can change for the next series of the Downtown Phoenix podcast. If you have any ideas and suggestions, please send them along to our website, downtownphoenixpodcast.com. Thanks for listening to that, and now, as usual, some perspective. One of the most important things in an urban area is how people go from point A to point B and everywhere in between. This episode of the podcast features three different angles on the transportation question: a very policy-oriented overview on what the City of Phoenix sees as its policies in downtown transportation, a conversation on the transportation equity question, but, and I think this is the most important policy discussion that ought to be had, how we can work in partnership to promote equally accessible transportation options for people with disabilities. So my signature conversation on this 7th episode of the podcast is with Jennifer Longden, who is one of this community's most vocal advocates for equity of people with disabilities. Her story underlines something that few of us ever think about. In one moment, she became paralyzed as a result of random gunfire. To all of us, it should give us great pause. It just takes one accident or one incident to transform our lives into something that we might not have imagined. I am reminded of the former mayor of Bogota, the capital and largest city in Colombia, Enrique Peñalosa, who promoted equity and equal access in improving that city's transportation infrastructure. He has said, quote, "All this pedestrian infrastructure shows respect for human dignity. We are telling people you are important," end quote. There have been significant strides in the City of Phoenix to get that. Still, though, more work needs to be done. As we have mentioned on the previous 2 weeks' episodes of the Downtown Phoenix podcast, the city is evaluating its budget program for the fiscal year 2014-2015. We are, after all, a podcast of action. And the first step to building a quality city is to show up. So let's continue to get to work. My first guest on this episode of the podcast is Mark Melnichenko, the Special Projects Administrator for the City of Phoenix Street Transportation Department. He is tasked with overseeing the city's reassessment of downtown transportation needs through the new Downtown Transportation Plan, a multi-year project that looks at what downtown Phoenix's transportation needs will be in the future. My conversation with Mr. Melnichenko was recorded on the 8th of April, 2014, in the studios of Downtown Phoenix, Inc. in Downtown Phoenix. And Mark Melnichenko, welcome to the Downtown Phoenix podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start, explain what this new Downtown Phoenix transportation plan is and how does it differ from either the current or previous downtown transportation plans?
Well, I'll give you a little bit of background first. This is really a subset. We've been working with MAG in partnership, the City of Phoenix and MAG, on this project and project funding. And our study area, which includes 7th Street to 7th Avenue and McDowell Road to Buckeye Road, was just a small component of the larger Central Phoenix Framework study, which MAG is finalizing right now. So we went to them and worked out this specific project area where we are looking at improvements to the transportation network and also looking at, in the past we've looked at moving of vehicles. Now we're looking at how we can improve the movement of people by adding additional modes of transportation downtown, bicycles, improvement of pedestrians, pedestrian areas, as well as there's going to be two additional light rail lines coming downtown. So it's a looking at the full network downtown from a 10,000-foot view.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked a little bit about boundaries. So again, what are the boundaries of this specific study?
7th Avenue to 7th Street, and then to the north, McDowell Road, to the south, Buckeye.
I think lots of people are asking what's in this transportation plan. It's phased. Just briefly talk to me a little bit about what the phases are and what some of the specific elements of this plan is.
Okay. We're looking at a three-tiered phasing effort. 0 to 5 is, I think it...
And 0 to 5 years out, right?
0 to 5 okay. years, yep. There's 0 to 5, 6 to 10, and 11+. And we understand that when additional funding is available and new timeframes for development, that these things will change. What we wanted to do was put together a plan that begins to put down on paper what we're seeing downtown and address the growth that's occurring from ASU, from other development activities that are adding more density, as well as other modes coming into downtown. So. Yeah, and that's how we try to also look at that timing schedule is when is rail coming in that we need to make these activity or these recommended changes. And so when we're looking at 0 to 5 years, the major improvements that we're looking at first is the changing of 3rd Street from one-way to two-way. That's a very important street or corridor for the city. First, it's a major component of the Reinvent Phoenix planning effort in the Midtown area. In addition, it has been planned as part of the 3rd Street Promenade, and then it is the number one bicycle corridor as part of the Bike Master Plan. In addition, ASC was also looking at expansion to the south of the railroad tracks in downtown in the Grant Street area. And so what we wanted to do was make sure that that is a very important component of our plan and linking with all of these other efforts. So that's really the first one. It would be a changing of one-way to two-way throughout the corridor, as well as the addition of bike lanes in that. 5th Street would also be part of that. And then to go along with the additional bike facilities, we would look towards making the connections that are missing right now between 7th Avenue and 7th Street on Washington and Jefferson in the downtown area for bike lanes.
And then what are some of the longer-term visions, 6 to 10 years and 10 years plus out?
Okay. 6 to 10 years, we really start to look at first possibly taming the sevens. We're focusing our efforts kind of taking a bite-sized morsel to begin that change, which was a very important item brought up through our focus groups in our efforts in getting feedback from downtown stakeholders. And so that goes along with the other item that's brought up, our gateway features coming into downtown. And I think the sevens provide us with an opportunity to do that. If we're able to take some lanes away and create a stronger pedestrian environment in connections to the businesses, I think a reduction of speeds, reduction in lanes, I think it would provide that gateway as well as a sense of place in downtown. That's really the first major element. The next one, we're really starting to make some changes, and that's looking at Central Avenue. With the addition of light rail, we feel that some changes need to be made on Central Avenue and how we address traffic concerns. Over the years, we've seen some reductions in the downtown with traffic along Central Avenue with the inclusion of rail. And if we see the I-10 West coming in, as well as the South Central segment, three light rail lines coming into downtown, we're looking at possibly a train every 2 to 3 minutes. And so what we had envisioned as part of the recommendations was to move Central Avenue from Washington to Van Buren more into a transportation-only type street, where we would include rail, a major busway for our regional bus connections during the day, a bike facility, and then also bump out the pedestrian area on the east side of the street to provide a stronger sidewalk, passenger waiting area, and then maybe even some cafe area for the hotels, one that will be coming in the near future.
A concern that has always been brought up has been the potential closure of Central Avenue to automobile traffic. Is that happening or is that not happening?
That's a concern that we've heard from the business community in through this outreach. What we would do, we're looking at limited access for vehicles that would provide access to the lone parking garage on Central Avenue, as well as the hotels for deliveries, and then even access to some of the businesses. So we would have limited access for vehicles on that street. It wouldn't be totally closed off.
And then you mentioned Central Avenue becoming a transit mall, or more or less a transit mall facility. Mm-hmm. Is that in replacement of Central Station, as an RFP for development on that parcel of land is out there for possible proposals? Or would this transit mall work as a complement to Central Station?
It would work as a complement, because I believe that the RFP has asked for some of the transit activity to be retained on site. So in other words, if we were to move transit activity onto the street, or if we were to remain on site for Central Station, it would work in tandem with these improvements.
And then going back to the Taming the Sevens, I think that's a great idea. But we've seen a recent development along 7th Street that isn't exactly pedestrian-friendly or walkable. How do you justify these pedestrian enhancements to a corridor that isn't exactly pedestrian-friendly in the design of the buildings along it?
Well, I think we should look at that as a first step.
Okay.
There are numerous uses, and there has been discussion of overhead bridges across 7th Street. I think from the project team perspective, that really shouldn't even be considered. I think we should design our streets to be safe to cross, especially in the downtown area. We have museums on either side, a children's museum and science museum, the bio campus, the preparatory school. All these things should be in a safe street environment and connections being made. So that's kind of how we look as maybe this is a first step in mm-hmm. making that happen.
I think in my community, my correspondence and talking to Phoenix transportation people, you're the first person who has said we need to focus on making our streets safer to cross, as opposed to just designing pedestrian bridges to avoid those areas. So I
think we're running away from the problem if we do that.
There are brownie points, and you can collect that at the door.
Yeah.
Lots of emphasis, Mark, has been placed on bicycling infrastructure in the city. As you know, the city is considering a new bicycle master plan. There are groups, as we've talked about last week on this on the Downtown Phoenix podcast, talking about advancing bicycling infrastructure. The Phoenix spokespeople is certainly a group that has come to the fore. But what bicycling infrastructure enhancements are proposed as part of this plan, and is equal emphasis given to pedestrian enhancements?
The to go along with your question, I think the next phase, this project is really a 10,000-foot view
right.
of improvements that we should be considering. What we would, if funding were in place, I know that there's a needs assessment that has been submitted by Streets and is being worked through the elected officials. But how we would work this plan is if this plan's approved, then we would look at implementing specific corridors, we would go specifically toward those improvements and put together a detailed plan where we would work with the recommendations from the Bike Master Plan, mm-hmm. specifically on what type of infrastructure would be needed and used, as well as what pedestrian improvements, connectivity, other amenities in that corridor that would be implemented as part of that specific design plan.
Mm-hmm. The previous downtown transportation plan features a controversial element that's been called the Sunburst Plan, as you know. Mm-hmm. And as you alluded to earlier, the idea is to move cars in and out of downtown easily for events at U.S. Airways Center, Chase Field, and the like. Some elements of this plan look like a scaled-down version of Sunburst, but still Sunburst-like. It's a criticism that's been echoed a lot about this. How is this plan just simply not Sunburst 2.0?
Well, as part of our plan, we're actually in the midst of looking at potential modifications that make the Sunburst plan better. What we feel right now is it's a little bit of an overkill, and we're going to be working with the downtown events management team because there's a lot of stakeholders to deal with. We can't, it's not just the residents. This is going to be dealing with all of the events leadership. And so what we need to do, I think the goals that we're looking at for the Sunburst plan is to make sure that the large pedestrian area outflux of people from the events, that's a safe area, as well as the outflow from the garages. But I really don't think, and it's our professional judgment, that vehicles need to be guided miles out of the area, because I think what we're trying to do is make it so that more and more people stay downtown, mm-hmm. and are excited to be here and possibly to live, to work, as well as spend money and use the resources downtown.
And last question, what's next for this plan? I know you came from a city council or a subcommittee meeting to discuss this plan, but from a policy standpoint, an implementation standpoint, what's next and how can people get involved to make their opinions known on this project?
The next step here after our final recommendations on the Sunburst plan and working that through the approval system is that we would be taking this to the Transportation and Infrastructure Subcommittee for City Council in I believe it's on May 13th. That would be the next step. From there, I think we would have to receive some guidance on where we go from there, because much of it it deals with the funding issue.
Mark Milnichenko, City of Phoenix Street Transportation Department. Thanks for spending some time with us this
afternoon. Thank you very much for having me.
You can learn more about the Downtown Phoenix Comprehensive Transportation Assessment at our website, downtownphoenixpodcast.com. My next guest on this transportation episode of the podcast is Feliciano Vera. A native of Phoenix, but a student of cities and urban environments around the world, Feliciano is a developer that understands the unique urban condition of Phoenix. He joined me on the 11th of April, 2014, in the Downtown Phoenix, Inc. studio. I asked him first what his story is.
I was a latchkey kid growing up. My father was a firefighter, retired in the not-too-distant past from the Phoenix Fire Department. My mother was an account clerk for the City of Phoenix. And if you know anything about public safety officers and the way their lives kind of work, in Phoenix at least, firefighters are on 24 hours and they're off 48 hours. So what that meant for me is as a 9-year-old, my dad, had every third day off. And so there came a point where my mom was working and the decision was that, hey, every third day, you're going to have to take the bus, not the city bus, the school, or not, I'm sorry, not the school bus, the city bus, home. And, you're going to have to take your brother with you. And you guys are going to have to chill out for a couple of hours before we get home. So you got chores you got to do. And so we looked at it as a big adventure. And so I grew up at the base of South Mountain, off of 16th Street and Baseline. So this was This was when there were nothing but flower orchard or Japanese flower gardens, orchards. Baseline was a 2-lane street. It was still very, very much a rural agrarian community. But because of the way the city evolved, it was an agrarian community that was that had a large Chicano population, a large African American population, large Eastern European population, and so the communities that you know, evolved from really what call it the late 40s, so early post-war years to my childhood were it was a very integrated community, and so when I caught the bus, I caught the bus at 7th Street and Alta Vista, which is right next to El Reposo Park, and so I learned very early on what it was like to be independent via transit, and that's kind of an oxymoron in this town, and a lot of but as a 9-year-old, as a kid, I mean, being able to catch a bus unsupervised without your parents is incredibly liberating, and so I had this tremendous amount of freedom that my parents invested in us, and fortunately we demonstrated that we were capable of taking care of ourselves, and that freedom continued to grow, and so leading up to a point where I didn't get my driver's license until the day before I left for college in Boston, and the only reason I got my driver's license was because I needed identification to open up a bank account, and so I didn't have the typical experience of most kids or most folks my age where the coming of age story was really wrapped around getting a car. I mean, my parents on my 16th birthday gave me a car. Unfortunately, it was a scale model of a Volkswagen Beetle, and so it was definitely you had to have a thick skin in my house. So for me, I had a very, very different way of looking at the world, and so transitioning from those experiences growing up to Boston as a college student, it opened up my mind to this really jarring contrast between the way Phoenix worked and operated and the way a city like Boston worked and operated. Now, Boston obviously is almost 400 years old. We've got some anniversaries here coming up, in fact, in the next 2 decades. Harvard, my alma mater, is going to be 400 years old in 22 years. So it's kind of scary. So these are cities. This is a region that has had very, very different built form and urban environment as a consequence of its age, because these are cities that evolved when pre-motorized transportation, and so they evolved around old cattle trails, old footpaths, and so from an automotive perspective, they're very tough to navigate, and you really have to know the cities. Whereas Phoenix, I mean, being the post-war city that it is, it really evolved around the automobile as a primary mode of transit, transportation, and that kind of left us in a situation where we didn't have the kind of robust connections that other cities have. And what I began to find in Boston was that it was perfectly acceptable and perfectly normal to take public transit. You take the red line, and you're on the red line with professors, with investment bankers, with lawyers, with officials and executives that are reading a copy of the Globe, reading a copy of the Times, reading a copy of the Wall Street Journal, and they're right alongside kids that are going to school, right alongside folks that are going to go work at the local bodega or fast food restaurant, and so it was a very, very different, very liberating experience. You could live a complete life without being tied to a car. And as a young man, that really impacted the way I began to think about my hometown and my city and the limits that we put on ourselves. Without any malice aforethought, it was more a matter of, well, hey, you know, this is the technology and this is what people want. We're reacting to what the market's telling us, but not necessarily thinking that through, thinking what that means from a competitiveness standpoint, from a civil society standpoint. And I would argue that we're in a very unique position now in 2014, where we're beginning to wrestle with the realities that hey, a robust civil society, a robust public life is absolutely integral to the efficient functioning of our markets. And we're seeing that. We're seeing those connections we're seeing those connections online. We're seeing those connections physically in the form of any number of commentaries that are starting to evolve, or that you're starting to that I see regularly and I read regularly about the way markets like, again, Boston function, San Francisco, New York City, all of these cities that have fairly compact footprints that have very robust public environments and happen to have the economic engines that are largely driving innovation in this country. And that innovation, you know, doesn't occur in a vacuum. It occurs within the context of these robust networks of connections, these robust networks of places where people can connect and can talk. You know, the coffee houses were where this country was created. The Boston coffee houses and pubs were where the revolutionary ideas that gave birth to our nation were created. And that's no accident. It's because we as human beings are social creatures, and we, you know, we crave that interaction. We crave that contact. And what we've done here in Phoenix, again, as a, you know, again, without being malicious about it, we've created a built environment that is very much antithetical to this idea of connection, this idea of conversation. And if it's antithetical to this idea of conversation, where it's very easy to get into your car in a garage, in your garage, drive out your garage and into either your garage or your parking lot where your job is, and not deal with anybody, not even really talk with your fellow drivers, it's very easy to just exist in a bubble and to kind of get isolated and trapped in that absence of conversation. And so arguably we've got a built environment that has a very, very poor set of social connections and a very, very weak social fabric that doesn't necessarily lend itself to strengthening our economy and our competitive position to inspire and attract creatives, thought leaders, business leaders, and capital. But we're fixing that. We're fixing that. The first markers were put on the table by Mayor Goddard in the 80s with the failed Beltrans initiative. The torch continued to be carried by Mayor Johnson up into 1994 on a regional level when we failed to secure reauthorization of Prop 400. But Mayor Rimza was really, I think, in our lifetimes, the one mayor who was absolutely critical in exploring, helping us explore some alternative futures for Phoenix and the Phoenix metropolitan region, when he pushed for the 1997 Keep Phoenix Moving transit referendum. And when that failed by 122 votes, he was pissed. And he had every reason to be, because it was so incredibly close. And really, there were any number of reasons that the failure of that election could could be attributed to. But he was determined. He was dogged. And he went out. He had a fire in his belly after that loss. And we were successful in passing Transit 2000 in March of 2000, less than 18 months. Less than 18 months after. Well, I take that back. What, 24? Anyway, it's two, three years after the passage or the failure of the 1997 Keep Phoenix Moving campaign. And, you know, and so we haven't looked back ever since. Now we're on the precipice of something hopefully even greater. I mean, we are, you know, we've got a legion of users, a legion of folks that are beginning to understand, that have developed lifestyles around the utilization of transit, around riding their bikes, around really, you know, a lifestyle that doesn't have a car at the center of it. And they're aggregating in Central Phoenix. They're aggregating in Tempe. They're aggregating in the urban core. And they're beginning to find out that, hey, you know what? I'm not the only crazy one that thinks that this is possible. And so what you're seeing is this groundswell of support that is informed by real life experience that Phoenix is actually a wonderful place to live and work and play. And guess what? To do that, you don't necessarily need a car. It's a secret. You know, it's largely a secret right now. But mm-hmm. but they're starting to get the word out. And so so on Tuesday, there were a couple of momentous things that happened. This past Tuesday, the city council I approved on a 9-0 vote an issue near and dear to your heart. I know they approved the master plan for Hants Park, which is a critical piece of civic infrastructure in downtown Phoenix. But immediately after that, made a motion to impanel a 35-person citizen committee to study how we continue and potentially expand our transit funding as well as funding for our streets infrastructure. So staff, city staff gets it. I think, you know, I think that the public gets it, business community starting to get it. And so all of which is to say that's a long-winded way of getting back to the point. That's kind of how I got here. Mm-hmm. So.
And I note that both Feliciano and I both serve on the ad hoc bicycling and pedestrian task force with the city of Phoenix, and I think there's a lot of good work that's happening in that group, and I think the group that is there, both the citizens but also the staff, I think that we collectively get it.
I would say yes. I think that we're in a very, very this is a shift. There's a generational shift that's occurring,
right,
in leadership within the city organization, within the city writ large, and our region, and it's an historic shift from the mores and temperaments of the baby boomers to the mores and temperaments of the millennials. I'm squished in between because I'm an Xer, but I was always a statistical anomaly in terms of my taste, so I never know where I fit in. Having said that, it's a really, really profound time, I think, mm-hmm. and there are some magnificent changes that are occurring that I think are going to benefit our ability to compete, to attract talent and retain talent,
right?
And that was something that I picked up on it at the Reinvent Phoenix closing last Friday when the folks from Duane Platter-Zyberg made their concluding presentation, and one of the points that they made was that, you know, Phoenix is actually beginning to retain its talent. It's young people. So our students from ASU and the other universities and community colleges here here in the metropolitan region are beginning to look at Phoenix as being someplace that they want to stay. It's not the Phoenix that I grew up in, where, you know, if you grew up here, you wanted to get out of Dodge as quickly as you could if you had the opportunity to get out. And so it was an anathema for me to come back to Phoenix. I could have easily been an investment banker on Wall Street. I could have been a congressional staffer. Instead, I made the decision to come back home. And I think for me, a lot of that was because of the opportunity that I began to see just by walking the streets and having those experiences as a bus rider, as a subway rider in Boston, and as somebody who just spent a lot of time thinking about what this place could be.
Exactly. Every time, apropos to your comments about Boston again, every time I've heard you make some sort of public speech or remarks to something, you always reference the former mayor of Bogota, Enrique Peñalosa. This is not to inquire if you're part of the Enrique Peñalosa Phoenix Appreciation Society.
I blame it all on Teresa Bryce from LISC.
we will certainly note that. But you know, I'm looking at some quotes of the former mayor of Bogota, and I think one of them, which I've heard you mention before, mm-hmm. An advanced city is not a place where the poor move about in cars, but it's where the rich use public transportation.
Yes.
I took on my way to record this conversation with you, Feliciano. I took light rail from where I live up at near the Heard Museum to mm-hmm. to here in downtown Phoenix, and we're not there yet. I don't think it's getting better. Mm-hmm. I think more socioeconomic diversity mm-hmm. on light rail, mm-hmm. but I think there's still, and others have commented that there's still some classism. Absolutely.
I mean, the reality is that when we fought to secure passage of Keep Phoenix Moving and eventually won passage of Transit 2000, there was a substantial undercurrent of you know, nobody's going to ride it, and it's just nothing but a bunch of poor folk that are going to ride it. Well, yeah, that's you know, that's true. I mean, there's a good chunk of our population that is transit dependent, but there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's nothing wrong with investing in tools and in infrastructure that enhance access to opportunity. I mean, what's more American than wanting an opportunity nothing's guaranteed in this life, but if you've got an opportunity to improve your situation, to improve your lot in life, then we should avail ourselves of that. And that's something that we haven't really thought of here. I mean, our transportation infrastructure and our investments in transit are arguably an investment in those constitutive components of economic freedom and of self-reliance, because they provide a very meaningful way for people to access employment opportunities, to access business opportunities, to access educational opportunities. And so what fascinates me about Peñalosa is that here's a gentleman that really took the helm of a city that was arguably in dire circumstances. You know, he was mayor of Bogota in the early part of the 2000s, still very much an active politician. But this is a gentleman that really was looking at a city that was weighed down by the burden of an initial collapse in civic infrastructure that was a function of the narco trafficking that paralyzed the entire country for many, many years. In the early post-Civil War years in Colombia, he really started driving home some points about that very notion that, hey, you know what? If we want people to access work, access just the basic component parts of life, we have to be able to make sure that people have, that we have good sidewalks, that we have good, good bike infrastructure, that we have good transit infrastructure, because a lot of folks in his community, couldn't afford a car. And so as I look at kind of that bold leadership that he inspired and he undertook, he single-handedly transformed a city, and his perspective, I think, has opened up a lot of eyes in terms of what is possible and why it's possible, and really I think what is possible with very, very limited resources and just some simple changes in language and whether that's policy language or just public language about how we view our streets as cousins of parks, or our sidewalks as cousins of parks and not of streets. And he fought this idea that, hey, parking is a right, because it's not a constitutional right anywhere in the world. And so for him, that was a huge war, because they didn't have in Bogota, there's very little parking infrastructure too. And so you have this very real fight going on a day-to-day basis on sidewalks where cars would park and force pedestrians to walk in the middle of the streets. And so the conflicts between pedestrians and bicyclists and cars were much more profound than they are here. But he really pushed home this notion that equity isn't about giving anything away. This is about having a well-functioning, well-oiled market, a well-functioning, well-oiled civil society that supports that market and that plays off of that market and informs how that grows. So it suggests that we kind of limit our vocabulary about the possibilities that can occur here in a place like Phoenix. And I think that we've got some exciting opportunities to really buttress the strengthening, buttress the market here, and while at the same time strengthening our civil fabric.
I think that's an excellent note on which to end. Feliciano Vera, thanks for spending some time with us this
morning.
Thank you,
Ed. Appreciate it.
We will be back with more of the Downtown Phoenix podcast, including my conversation with Jennifer Longden, after this. As I mentioned at the top of the show and in my perspective essay, my signature conversation on this episode of the podcast is with Jennifer Longden. She is one of our community's fiercest advocates for a lot of different things, but most notably, her work for people with disabilities. A random gunfire incident years ago changed the trajectory of her life, and she is now paralyzed and a full-time wheelchair user. Jennifer joined me on the 11th of April, 2004, from the Downtown Phoenix studios. And Jennifer Longden, welcome to the Downtown Phoenix podcast.
Thank you.
I guess I want to start, I've asked the guests I've had on here previously what their story is that brings them to this moment right now. I guess share your story. What gives you this voice that you have right now?
Thank you for asking. Since no one can see me, I guess where I need to start is, first off, I'm a longtime Phoenician. I've lived here for nearly 20 years. About 10 years ago, I sustained a spinal cord injury, and I'm a full-time wheelchair user. And with that, my entire perspective quite literally changed. And since that time, I've worked to ensure universal accessibility for all people.
We're talking, obviously on our podcast, we have a very downtown centric view.
Mm-hmm.
But the issues facing people with disabilities is not confined to just downtown areas. It's a universal issue. Your assessment of the transportation infrastructure, Jennifer, in Phoenix, how would you grade it, and what policies, what, uh, perceptions might you suggest to improve that infrastructure?
Well, I think there's plenty of room for improvement. And I think that the first place we need to start is with a fundamental understanding that individuals with disabilities are just that, people. We're just people. And we need to disabuse ourselves of this notion that people with disabilities are inactive or helpless, because individuals with disabilities are doing all the same things that everyone else is. We work, we play, we have families, we socialize, we take full advantage of all of the same amenities that everyone else does in the city. We just need to access them sometimes slightly differently. And I think that when we accommodate disability fully, those universal changes that we make the city friendlier to everyone, people with strollers, people on rollerblades, or individuals who are moving heavy packages or cargo, all of that sort of stuff. There's not an issue in our city that you can cut across that doesn't have some specific impact on the disability community.
At last year's city council elections, as they were happening both in August and in November and the lead up to them, it was mentioned that none of the candidates had brought up with a good discussion issues of accessibility. Why do you think that was?
Well, I'm going to make a small correction. There were 19 candidates, mm-hmm. I believe, at that time for city council. One originally drafted a policy on disability issues. That was Lawrence Robinson in City 8. And then another candidate, after announcing Laura Pastor, who is the councilwoman for City 4, also developed a specific policy on disability issues. I wish I understood better why that were. The disability community is the single largest minority population in the United States. 1 in 3 Phoenicians experiences disability. And here's the good and the bad news that a friend of mine, Amina, hello Amina, is fond of saying. There's good news and bad news. With 100% certainty, I can tell you that you will be disabled in your lifetime, unless you die first. So find what comfort you can in that. It may be a temporary disability. I can tell you that before my spinal cord injury, I experienced disability a couple times. I had a very difficult pregnancy. I dislocated a knee and couldn't walk. I had major surgery that required a long convalescence, and everyone will experience these temporary periods of disability. Some may experience permanent disability, and that's probably my single crusade, is to make sure we're aware that this is going to touch every one of us in our lifetime, and it's important we get it right.
We're talking a lot in downtown about enhancing infrastructure for bike lanes. We're, mm-hmm. we're talking about enhancing the pedestrian experience. But we haven't seen, and if there has been, then I retract the statement. There isn't a hasn't been as vocal in their advocacy, or at least it's always shadowed out by these other interests.
I wouldn't say that we're not as vocal. I would say that we're just not heard as often. And there are certainly individuals that hear us quite well, and I don't want to negate that. But I think what I want to be really clear on is, in terms of these special interests, you know, as we're talking about the general plan and the Phoenix budget and all of these other issues, it's not us instead of them. That's not at all what we're trying to get
Absolutely.
At. It's us too. Please remember us as well. And again, the enhancements that we make that improve lives of individuals with disabilities also create improvements that are good for everyone. Mm-hmm. It's not if you create better wheelchair access, I'm the only one, or people in wheelchairs and walkers and scooters are the only ones that will benefit. You'll benefit as well when you're dragging along your rolling case, when you're pushing your stroller, when your kids, as much as I hate to see them on the sidewalks, but when they're on their scooters and their rollerblades and this sort of thing, it creates a better experience for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Like we'd all would benefit from shade.
Indeed. And that's critical. Speaking of shade, individuals with disabilities, especially like, for example, I have a spinal cord injury, so I don't regulate my body temperature. Mm-hmm. 10 minutes outside in full sun in August can quite honestly, literally, no joke, be fatal. So shade is hugely important to me. My friends with sensory disabilities, for example, individuals who are blind, who might they don't drive, so they may be more pedestrian. They may walk further from point A to point B, would absolutely benefit from shade. We need good shade. We need to make sure that there's cooling as much as possible at places where people wait for transportation. Some of the light rail stations are air-cooled, mm-hmm. and that's very helpful. I'd mm-hmm. like to see all of them air-cooled. That would be incredible.
Well, yeah, the two core stations in downtown Phoenix that serve the ballpark and convention center mm-hmm. are the two air-conditioned stations. Mm-hmm. You talked about the general plan. Mm-hmm. Have you had a chance to review the general plan?
I have definitely looked at it a number of times. And what I'm very pleased is that after speaking with the mayor, he did appoint a specific individual to represent the voice of individuals with disability to his advisory group on the general plan. So I know that those interests are being represented in those meetings.
Excellent. When transportation advocates are asked about issues of accessibility, mm-hmm. One of the things that they always say is, there's always ADA requirements that they have to adhere to.
Right.
I don't think I need to say more about that. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, Are those requirements substantial enough, and could more be done? Mm-hmm. I'm sure more could be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you, for example, light rail complies with ADA standards largely, but individuals with disabilities still have access issues with light rail. A number of fare boxes were installed on grade. Mm-hmm. If you use a mobility device, whether it's a walker or a cane or a wheelchair, staying steady on grade while you interact with the fare box can be difficult. The signage on the fare boxes is difficult to be viewed at a height level that some little people in wheelchairs are at. So we have trouble reading the screen. Individuals who are blind absolutely have issues with the screen. The gap between the platform and the trains seems to be pretty good, but there are no lockdowns. There's no way to lock down a mobility device. So if you are if you're on a scooter or in a wheelchair, we can very quickly turn into a missile, a big old meat missile. How get that mental picture? If the train doesn't run very smoothly, and that's an issue of who's operating it. Mm-hmm. Some of them take off very smooth and slow down very smoothly, and some don't. And it's pretty much, luck of the draw what your experience is going to be. And I don't think that able riders experience that at the same way.
It's hard for me to... I say this as someone mm-hmm. who is fully physically capable, mm-hmm. An able-bodied, to project myself onto the different conditions that you face on a mm-hmm. daily basis, and it's very challenging to think in different terms. But as I was talking to a colleague of mine earlier today, who previously had worked with the Arizona Bridge to Independent Living.
Great group.
Had said, for a lot of people, and this certainly is true in your case, it was one moment mm-hmm. that changed, this word's overused, but literally changed the trajectory of your life.
Absolutely.
And everyone is one moment away from something similar mm-hmm. happening to them. How to those who want to take the cause or to join the cause of promoting equal accessibility mm-hmm. and to note it's working alongside current systems as opposed to this or this, what suggestions do you have? What resources are out there for people to learn about access issues for and all issues facing people with disabilities so that we can our community can work alongside you?
That's a great question. First, I think that what's important is to understand within my community, there's a mantra from one of our pioneers, Justin Dart, nothing about us without us. I don't want you to go out and do this for me. Mm-hmm. I want you to do it with me. Right. And that's what you're asking, Eddie, and I appreciate that. So I think that one of the first things is look around. Again, one in three Phoenicians has a disability of one sort or another. So while you're on the platform, look around. Are there individuals that have identifiable disabilities? Certainly there are any number of individuals with invisible disabilities. But if you're not throughout your day encountering individuals with disabilities just doing the same thing everyone else does, then you have to wonder, why are we missing? And that's the big issue. Because we're not there, our access and functional needs aren't addressed, aren't considered. And because our access and functional needs aren't considered, we're not there. Organizations like ABLE are fantastic. The Statewide Independent Living Council is another great global group. Every individual, I'm trying to find a better way to say this, but every individual classification, if you will, of disability will have its own particular advocacy group. The National Federation for the Blind, the Spinal Cord Injury Association, UCP, on and on. So you certainly have opportunities to get involved in those ways, but make sure that your boards and your commissions, make sure that your organizations are fully inclusive. And when you're talking about diversity and you're talking about all of the other factors, make sure disability is one of them.
I think that's a very poignant statement, the last part. And I think it's something that when we consider diversity, we don't always remember, and I'm sure it's not with any malice aforethought,
no.
but we don't always consider physical disability as a key element of diversity.
Mm-hmm. Can I just one more thing? I mean, I agree 100%, but just because there's no malice meant doesn't mean I'm not still stuck sitting at home, not able to attend, my best friend's daughter's concert. Mm-hmm. The reason behind that can sometimes be less important than the fact that we're just simply isolated through lack of access.
What elements are there in the general plan that address, in the City of Phoenix general plan that address these issues?
Well, again, I think that when we're talking about where we put shade, where we put bike lanes, how we and let's talk about bikes for a second.
Sure.
Now, perhaps individuals with visual impairments may not be able to ride bikes, and folks that use power wheelchairs may not. But I can tell you in Europe, which is a very cycle-centric society overall, places where you can rent or lend bikes, bike share places, mm-hmm. also have an attachment called Fun Bike in Germany, I know, that will attach to a wheelchair like mine so that I can hand cycle around my city. How awesome would that be? While I own a hand cycle, if I use it, I can't get off of it to go into a cafe or a store. With an attachment that I can take on and off my wheelchair and use that to turn it into a bicycle, then I could, stow that where everyone else stows their bikes and go in and shop or eat or socialize or whatever I wanted to do. So again, we're talking about bikes, but we're only talking about the bikes the way that we generally think about them in a very able-centric way. So when we're talking about bike share, why aren't we looking at how we can also interpret that more broadly so that a person with a balance issue or a mobility impairment could also enjoy that same bicycle lane. And that's some of the things that we need to look at. Mm-hmm. That's that me too, us too,
right,
that we need to consider.
I think that's an excellent start to begin.
It's a
great start to begin a conversation and certainly for further examination. Jennifer Longton, thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Eddie. I appreciate it very much.
My thanks to Jennifer Longton for joining me on the podcast, and my thanks also to Liana Rowe for helping to arrange this conversation. That will do it for this episode of the Downtown Phoenix podcast. You can find links to guests and to our community calendar and our show notes all on our website, downtownphoenixpodcast.com. can also find links to where we are on Facebook and Twitter. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/downtownphoenixpodcast and Twitter at the username DTPHXpodcast. Next week's episode, we will be talking about communities and neighborhoods that aren't always included in the downtown conversation. And it will also be our series finale of the Downtown Phoenix podcast. Well, for the first series, we'll be back, don't worry. We'll be back next week with that episode. Thanks for joining us on this week's episode of the podcast. So long. This is the Downtown Phoenix Podcast, an Edward Jensen Urban Production.